So just take, if I may, a couple of minutes, a general overview with this period of time for the inquiry. Initially with the first person that comes, this evening it's a woman who starts. And with, can you hear okay? All good at the back? And just a few pointers to remember. So during the days, with the fullness of the days, from your meditation experiences, reflections, instructions you've listened to, one-to-ones, talks and many other themes, sometimes that triggers a variety of interests or concerns. Do feel free to come and take the seat. The period of time with the one-to-one, which I regard as an interview, that in the interview that takes place, do remember as well that fullness of listening, so simultaneously it is both the outer listening and the inner listening, just learning to catch any responses. So it's very much part of our exploration and practice of mindfulness. And as the Buddha said consistently, mindfulness is both inner and outer. And this period of time is a good period of time for that kind of inner-outer practice. Anytime the person or myself can say thank you to bring the interview to a close, minute or two, as you know, of silence together, and then there is another invitation. And this is how the time flows. So anyone who wishes to come and take a seat is very welcome, very much invited, and the microphone is there. I will check with you that it's okay for it to be recorded, that can make it available to other people when it's up there in the cyberspace. Yes, anyone please. Yes, yes, please come. Yes. Is the recording?
Yes.
Okay. So then you just see the mic beside you. Yes. Hi.
Hi. I want to ask you.
Yes. Can you hear?
You hear? No. Now? I want to ask you what is your perception about death and life after death, if there's anything from your perspective about it?
All right. Can I avoid answering this difficult question for a moment or two? And I'm a little curious if I will respond. Anything currently that triggered this important area of interest for you about death, life after death, is there life after death? What does that mean? Does it mean anything? What's your response if the shoe was on the other foot? Meaning, I asked you, which I am, to avoid me answering. what's your response?
I can tell you why I'm asking.
You can.
Yes.
Oh,
but
good.
I don't know the answer.
No. All right. It will be helpful.
Like many of us,
mm-hmm.
Experience in my personal life,
mm-hmm.
A close person that died?
A close person died, yes, yes.
And it's always on my mind.
Mm, yeah, yeah. And when someone who is close to us dies, which leaves us with memories and feelings and experiences, what way is that person on your mind? What's can I ask what kind of responses arise for you when she or he comes to mind for you? The head shake means no words. Let me ask it another way. Is one of the two thoughts more comforting? There is life, there is death, it is finished and it is complete. One common view. Another would be common view. There is life, there is death, there is rebirth or reincarnation. Recycling, re-going on. There's another view, very common, religious. When we die, according to our actions and our beliefs, will determine whether we go to God or to hell. And when you hear these views, which people hold very sincerely, does any of them resonate, touch you more strongly? Doesn't have to, but I'm just curious if in our views of human beings, of life and death, and is there an afterlife, people have formed no. Yes, it's like this, or it's like that.
I do believe that in sort of way they are still with us.
Yes, all right.
I know that, I mean, I think that they are still inside
yes.
each one of us.
So. Precious to hear. So there is the presentation of the human being who had an important impact, and some of the qualities of that person have touched us deeply enough that it's resonated, and inside, with the memory and the perceptions, it seems genuinely that the person in some way or other has left behind, as it were, something of themselves, so to speak, and that's still with us. But would that sense and feeling that someone is still with us answer your earlier question? Is there life after death in some form, or there isn't? We have this life on this existence and it's complete and that's finished. It's enough.
For me it's enough, but I wanted to ask you if maybe, because I think in Buddhism what I know is there's a lot of talking about
rebirth, reincarnation or rebirth.
Yes, reincarnation.
So I want to ask you what you think about it.
Well, fortunately, I'm not a Buddhist, so I don't have the problem. But I appreciate there's already enough identities in the world without adding another one. But more importantly, we touched upon in the talk this afternoon the larger picture. There's this great movement of life. We, you and I, and us, we're in this great movement of life, and it's a remarkable unfoldment which is going on. And we don't start life with the clean sheet, so to speak, but long for circumstances of history give shape to who and what we are. And all the undergoing changes, and it continues in this unfolding process, a little bit like waves on the ocean, we might say. Would it make any difference to your life if you believe in reincarnation or rebirth or some afterlife in some form? Would it make any difference to your life if you said, actually, I don't believe that. I believe that we have one life. Would it make any difference to your life either way?
No, but I'm curious about investigating it.
Yeah. It's truly worth investigating for sure there. Can we look at it another way? Many ways to look at this. There is the birth and death of each day. We wake up in the morning, we go to sleep at night, the day starts, stays for a while and finishes, the birth and death of each day. There's the birth and death of our experiences. There have been many over the days here. There's the birth and death of thoughts that come and go. Why should we make extra significance to the birth and death of a life? Why should we take that and give that a special significance, which is belonging to all the other births and deaths? Why do we want to do that? Sometimes with questions or with anxiety or with belief system. Why have we made this death, as it were, more important than all the others?
I guess from some people it gives them some relief.
Some relief. Which would be in any people that you know or in yourself? What kind of relief would you say? Is it the relief that something will continue after they die, or a relief? Oh, it's over, nothing more, it's finished. I've come to the end of this world. For some it's one way, and some relief can be in either direction, can't it? Some people don't want to have any thought of a future life, and some people get comfort that there might be or there could be. Difficult. I only ask hard questions. It's not my style asking easy ones. But the reason I ask is, you see, question and inquiry, it's an important area. I do think it's worth a lot of meditating on. I don't want to prescribe some nice, neat answer. And I don't think that's respectful to you. What's more important, even though it's difficult, just to listen inwardly with the responses, and then I'll give you a response in a minute or two. I think the understanding is with you, because you're human and you've experienced a tremendous amount of comings and goings, birth and death, arising and passing, presence and absence. You're used to it, you're human. So I say, why should we give extra to this one, extra importance? Why do we give extra importance to my death at some future point in time? What happens to me when I die? Or does anything happen to me? Why?
It's not about me.
No, all right. Go on.
It's about the people that I knew.
Yes. So but one day it will be about you, won't it? When you get close to death, huh? When the whole system says, "Whoa, I'm on the edge here."
Sometimes I think that when it happens, so I meet the people that.
Right. When my mother very very deeply religious, and as you said a few moments ago, she wasn't afraid of death because she got so much comfort and consolation that she would go to heaven and be with her ex-husband, who she argued with while she was on earth. and as my sister commented, the only reason she lived to just nearly 95, because my sister's religious as well, that my father, who didn't even believe in any of this stuff, who was up in heaven, would have been up there hoping and praying that she would come as late as possible. That's what my sister commented, and who am I to agree, disagree, etc. But for some, it really does give a lot of comfort and consolation. And like my mother would say her prayers every day, and she felt ready for this transition because she looked on the other side of it. But not everybody has that, and therefore would not have that consolation. So if we abide in the don't know, nothing absolute about it, what could be beneficial about just being in the don't know? Maybe this is the end. Maybe there is reincarnation. That means the self here moving to another. Maybe in this death, we are like waves on the ocean, and fresh waves. As the wave goes down, it reappears, and it goes down, and it reappears. And we are all waves on the ocean until we've gone to the deep and stopped being the wave. With not knowing and keeping it deeply open, be in some way deeply beneficial. To be deeply open, deeply receptive, the mind not coming in with the view, and we might find a resolution. Your head's slightly moving, but I'm not quite sure what direction. Were you able to hear us? It's not always easy listening when you've got this gang of people sitting in front of you. I repeat, because sometimes our mind, fair enough, wants to know. We might approach whatever the authority figure, the spiritual teacher, whatever. And in the, we would like some answers or some explanation. It might be satisfying, it might be not. It might be disagreeable, or it might not. It might be a view we both share, or it might not. There. I'm not sure, there is a resolution to this question. There's a very profound resolution to this question, which answers it once and for all. But I don't see it as being in the dualism, the duality, of life and death. So therefore, say, in the response or the answer to this deep, fundamental question of human existence, and it's a very profound one that you've brought up there, can I let the mind rest in not having an answer, not having an explanation, not concluding, oh, I haven't got an answer, I don't know, nobody knows, not leaving it at that, because the answer is not in the construction of the mind. There is a resolution, I say there is an answer, it can be realized, but it will not be realized in the duality of life and death. We're looking in the wrong direction. And therefore, the exploration in the deep answers this core question clearly. Enough?
Thank you.
Thank you. Quiet moment or two, then another invitation, any gender. Yes, anyone at any time. yes, please.
Hi.
Hi. All right with the recording?
Yes.
Okay, nice.
To continue on the subject of death. I personally like the view of Woody Allen.
Woody Allen.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens.
All right. What's the theme?
About you talked before. About the killing, the phrase of the Sila, one of the
The ethics, non-harming, non-killing, yeah.
And you said there that you don't, I think this is how you said, correct me, you don't want to be killed and therefore you don't want to inflict it on others.
I just said that, yeah.
And what I'm trying, thinking about killing and something that's on my mind, having killed before and being part of killing constantly of other creatures, why is it that you don't want to be killed, what's the difference between just dying and being killed?
You tell me. Someone comes up to you in the real world, and that person has the intention to hurt you, harm you, or kill you. Are you honestly going to tell me that you're going to say to that person, well, what's the difference between being killed, hurt and harmed now or later? Is that going to be your response?
No.
Why can't you say, any time, kill me? Why would it be a bit weird for a human being to have that view? What's your feeling? No speculation, please. You've got to keep with your feeling here.
Feeling is fear.
All right. So there's some. What would be the fear? Could be. Even without the fear, would there still be a response? It seems a bit unhealthy, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But my question is not how do I react to someone who wants to kill me.
Yes.
Let's say I got killed or someone did kill me.
Yes.
What's the difference if I killed by person or a bomb, or I don't know, then a car accident, or a tsunami, or a lion.
It's not quite clear. So, is the general view or question that you're asking, it doesn't matter the way that people suffer and die, sooner or later. Is that the view that you're offering? That you're considering? It doesn't really matter because everybody's going to die anyway. So. Can drop bombs on children, it doesn't matter, they'll die. Is that what you're asking?
No.
What are you asking? Make it clear then for me.
I'm asking whether killing is necessarily an act of violence. And why is it specified that not killing and not harming, and not just not harming or not committing an act of violence against someone, which killing is another form of it. Why is it specified? Is it necessarily a form of violence or harmful to your view?
How much exposure have you had to killing? How much exposure have you had to the willful slaughter? How many wars have you had contact and connection with? How many people have you seen suffer?
Yeah, sure, not as many as you.
Yeah.
In my military service,
mm-hmm.
being part of killing other people,
yes.
human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I have and still kill other creatures.
And which creatures are you currently killing?
Insects.
And what's the intention? They get in your way? They don't matter? They have no right to live? What's the view?
Yeah, some they get in my way, like when I work in the garden, for example. And some of them trying to protect my son from getting beaten.
Would there be another way for you to explore your whole relationship to sentient life, both human and creatures, than the one that I'm hearing?
Can you repeat?
Yeah, sure. Would there be another way to explore, for you to explore your relationship to life, both human and creatures? And I'm not speaking as a person who is advocating the creatures, the continual protection of life under all circumstances. When there was a mosquito swamp in the monastery, it was me who said this monastery has to be emptied out and cleaned out because of all the mosquitoes and some risk to those who come to the monastery because of malaria and bites and dengue fever and much, much more. So I'm not advocating under all circumstances. But I still want to hear a much deeper voice from you than the current one. And to come back to humans and creatures again, is there a deeper way to experience connection with others than the one you're offering?
I'm not sure what's the one I'm offering.
Well, what I'm listening to, what I'm hearing, is a question. It slightly sounds rhetorical. It means the question and the answer are almost there. That what's the difference between killing and hurting and harming somebody if it's going to happen anyway. They're going to die anyway. If that's not, if it's not what you're saying, you know, I might have got it wrong, do make the question short and precise so I know what precisely what the question is, but that's the feeling I get.
Again, if I try to make it accurate, why is killing necessary, necessarily harming or act of violence?
All right. The relationship to the killing of another, which to me is an act of violence, and that act of violence in the killing would show to me not only the suffering which is inflicted upon the other, but the killer shows a degree of reaction, projection, and view that this person has no right to life. That the killer, in the rage or in the cold-heartedness, is saying of the other, she or he or they have no right to live. And to take away the opportunity for a human being to live in this world, and to deny them that I find that the reason, a major reason, not to take somebody's life, not to even have the wish to do it, to respect their right to life. And I, as I've said many times here and in Britain and other countries, that respect for life is far more important than the controlling demands of the nation state. And I've said it again, and I'll say it here, and I've said it elsewhere many, many times. Not to submit to the control when people are told to go out and kill other people. And as one American soldier once said to me, and simplistic, but some truth in it, in the American war on the people of Vietnam, he said to me, war, where the most frequent killing obviously takes place, he said, it is the old, rich and powerful telling the young, poor and powerless to go and kill each other. And he knew, because he had been shot by the Viet Cong in the United States. What's your response?
I agree with this view of not, as you said, called taking someone's life. I'm also against war. I refuse to participate in war.
Good spirit, right.
And my question is more like on the more different circumstances, as said, protection or again, if it's not about human life and about other sentient beings, are there circumstances where killing is not an act of violence? And you said yourself that there has occurred in the monastery. Mm.
Yeah.
My exploration and my question is why is killing so specifically in the Sila, where there are obviously times where killing is needed.
The a primary reason for it, in my understanding as a human being who lives on the earth, that our connection with each other, that the protection we give is by support. There are occasions, not of the collective to blame there are occasions when the ending of the life, the cow which has broken its back, the dog which has cancer, and occasionally with the individual human as well, who really wishes and has the right to bring an end to their life. Support that wish. Understand that wish for certain people. But those actions and intentions are as careful and as rare as possible. So it's not an absolute rule. It's not an absolute commandment. But it is in precise, careful, specific situations. And on the larger field, we have a whole variety to resolve human conflict through communication. And that means diplomacy, it means aid, it means dialogue, it means meeting with people who one finds completely opposite views to oneself. It means a lot of engagement, it means total dedication. And through all the skills in giving support to people, to the environment, to their philosophy, to their ways of life, and much, much more, all of that to me has far more chance of resolving than this endless killing. And I think we have the duty and the responsibility not just to protest about war, but to find other ways to resolve human conflict. Because all war is, in my view, it's barbaric. It's a failure in communication.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for hanging in with the question. So, quiet moment, and then another invitation. Yes, anyone, any time? Anyone who hasn't been up before? Yes. Always gender balance. I'm keen on it. Thank you for coming. Yes, hey.
Hello.
Hello. Are you okay? Oh, nice, good spirit. Before we start, there's a couple of lovely giggles from you over there. One was yesterday evening, when the standing meditation, and I heard a giggle. And then another one, I think maybe the wooden meditation seat collapsed and that got you giggling.
No.
They need some humour in this hall. Honestly, there's some deadly serious meditators around. All right, anyway, go on.
So. Okay. I have a question.
Yes.
About your stand towards
Psychology.
Yeah. My stand towards it. Tell me, what is it?
I'm sorry.
Go on, what is
it? It seemed to me in the past few days that some of you...
Can't hear?
Hola, can you hear me?
No,
It felt like, for me, in the last few days, that there's some kind of anti-psychology
somewhat
stand. Some anti-psychology stand. So
oh,
I just
go
wanted
on.
To...
Yeah, yeah, mention it, absolutely.
Thank you for psychology.
Give me, please remind me, I've probably suppressed it. So, what are the occasions when I've expressed an anti-psychology stand? Tell me, I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I remember once you said, thank God I'm not a psychologist.
Did I? That's right, I said that.
Kind of these kind of words.
And some of my good psychologists in here might think, thank God he's not a psychologist. They would be embarrassed if I was in their network. All right. Anyway, carry on. Sorry. Any other one-liners which are not very helpful?
I remember when guy said, I can say something happened when I was 5 and but that's not the point. I mean, stuff like that. So, I don't know, it was...
So the attention is going to Guy. He's another anti-psychologist.
No.
Okay. Sorry, I'm teasing. Go on.
Me too.
All right. So, have I said anything at all which is appreciative of psychologists?
Today you said something about a girl that her father told her something horrible.
Yes, yes.
And
she
had to go to some therapy for and practicing for 8 years.
Yeah. Has it...
But then, also...
Go on.
You were talking about the self-compassion.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And how it's it seems like it's a bad thing. And... Mm. I'm not sure if I agree with that.
No, then don't. No problem. what might have been my motive today in expressing concern about self-compassion? I gave the reasons for it.
Yeah, I heard that when it's becoming... When the mark is on the self,
yeah, exactly.
Then it's a problem, of course.
Yeah, yes, and there is some through the repetition. There is some. I have some clear concern that the spirit of compassion is in the engagement for the genuine welfare and benefit for others. And just a little bit with that, have you heard me say over the days, last day or two, expressed appreciation for the huge networks of psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists?
Yes. And,
all right. Okay.
Yes.
Good.
But that's why I started my question is just, what's your stand?
What's the stance?
Yes.
Precisely that. So, there are a wide range of people in the hall here who, in the working life and outside of it, are really deeply committed to the resolution of suffering. And there's a wide variety of professions really concerned with it, concerned with the causes and conditions for it, concerned with its resolution and concerned with ways and means to resolve it. So that means that there are a wide variety of people in this hall who are truly applying the core of the Buddha's Dharma, which is the four truths. There is suffering, there are causes and conditions, there is the resolution, and there are ways to resolve. And therefore I say, this army or this network of people committed to this, there's a whole variety of ways, of which one of them, as I mentioned, is in here. There. And at times, I express concern. So one of the occasions, for example, that sometimes if there is too much psychology, too much thinking about childhood and the past, a person may be able to analyze that very well with the company of a skilled analyst or a psychology, but it may not make a fundamental transformative difference. So the person knows and has followed the track record, let's say a trauma, an unhappy childhood, really knows all the influences, but it may not make a fundamental difference. When it makes a difference to a person's life, I think it is genuinely, and I mean this, that process is extraordinarily helpful. There are ways of resolving deep problematic issues without the reference to the personal story of the relationship of the self to another self. It might be called parents, it might be called the bully in the school, or the sibling, or whatever. And so recognizing the benefits of the psychological approach, or some, let us say, to be fair, and recognizing it, like here, may have its limits. The resolution of the suffering is, for all of us, clearly the priority. And there are, as I'm to repeat it a bit, there are ways to go which may not have any reference to the past. There are ways to explore without knowing anything about the person's personal history. And that I think we can explore as well.
Also as a Western people.
Yes.
That, I don't know, I'll speak to myself.
Yeah, all right, okay.
Of course. As a Western white girl.
Yes.
Young lady.
Woman. Yeah, go on.
Who's being taught just to think,
yes,
almost just to think, and almost no feelings, when feelings have been shown,
yes,
was, no, that's no.
No, right.
I find psychology as a way to prove, to make some research and find the proofs for that.
Yes.
My proof here,
yes,
was that I have good intentions.
Yes.
And until, not today, but this year, I was almost sure that I'm a really bad person. And that's psychology. I don't know. That's how I see it.
All right, lovely. So, as you say in English, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Understand? The proof of the pudding is in the eating of it. So in this case, and fully with you, if your reflections, that means your thought about, contribute to an understanding, and then you see from your reflections, psychological reflections, you recognize that there has been certain kind of views which have been identified with as a white, Western, woman trained in thinking and so forth. And the benefit of that is you've looked and say, actually, that is not who I am. Actually, I can see that these intentions are healthy, are wholesome, are good intentions. And that is a precious outcome of those kind of psychological reflections. But it may not work that way for everybody. And people will do say to me, Christopher, I've done so much psychological work there, but it hasn't made the difference for me. And people will come on the retreats here, I've done a lot of retreats, Christopher, but it hasn't made the difference for me. And therefore you say, look, explore this, try this, here or there. Therefore, to keep heart and mind open as much as possible, okay, are there, which there are, other fresh ways to explore, so that none of us in this room or elsewhere actually think and believe we know the answer to human suffering. To repeat, it is a contribution. And so we need to know our strengths and our limits, what we can offer and that which we have not got the expertise or the insight with. Clear?
So I have another question.
Go on. An evolving question. Go on, yes.
Actually, I wrote it in the notes. So.
Pardon? I'm sorry?
No.
Right.
So, tomorrow when I wake up,
yes.
And I have a doubt.
You have a doubt?
In myself.
In yourself? If.
Probably will. If I have a doubt. When? The next time I have a doubt. In myself or in my good intentions. Mm. What should I do?
If you reflect this back a little bit, may I ask, to keep it, since arriving here, so 6 days, it's the evening time, have you had any doubts? And if so, what's the biggest doubt you've had in the past 6 days?
It was big.
If you wish to say.
I had a doubt in my intentions. If I'm just trying to be cute, or am I really cute?
To impress who?
The crowd.
Am I cute or trying to be cute? Go on.
Anything. All right. I had a doubt right. If I'm having a manic episode last evening. I wanted to leave.
Yes. All right. Fair enough.
Everything comes up.
Surely. So, would this be a fair way of describing doubt? There is a movement in the inner life, in the mind. It can be quite deep, and the doubt easily goes into the either or. Cute or not cute, stay or leave, good intentions or bad intentions, there. And it might be that we want to take up or hold on to one over the other, and this can create in the holding some tension, some pressure, because owing to the doubt there. So both are going on, because doubt requires two movements or more. Is it important to take up one and try and stop or block the other? Or could there be another way to relate to it?
My
to a doubt.
Was to have them both.
Huh?
It was.
Yeah, they have
it.
All right.
My answer too.
Okay.
It was from here, and I'm looking for.
Could. I agree. So I think one of the talks, yes, no, both, neither,
yeah.
Dynamic of the views. So there is a conflict, there is a doubt. This or that, shall I or shan't I? It can create, of course, a lot of stress and confusion. The initial response, which is just from the upper part of the mind, might say, I'm not going to go one way or the other. Let me see if I can just accommodate and embrace the two. Initially, it will seem like just another thought about. And for someone who's used thought a lot, like you say, it might seem it doesn't really have the power to change the mode of doubt, because it seems like just another thought has come in about what one should do. It is important to be as patient as possible, and like left hand and right hand, and you could look at the left hand and right hand. Can I just trust, stay with it, quietly, breathe with it, quietly, and see if there's the potential for something to go deeper. Deeper than just interpreting and thinking about. And then there's the potential for those two conflicting doubts either to dissolve, so then it's neither. It's just neither. It's not a matter, oh, I got to stay or I got to go there. Or it's quite clear which is the healthy one to respond to. And sometimes the healthy one sometimes is the most challenging. It's not to find the easy one. So if there's conflict, to breathe, to be quiet with it, to stay quietly, steady with it, a little trust that it will go deeper than just the thought there. It may let both of them just drop away. It's neither. Neither view is of interest to you. Both have dropped away. And one is quite steady with that, and one just gets on without the doubt. Could there be places, I'll turn the question to you for a moment, where doubt is wonderful, precious, and a tremendous step in the right direction? Head goes up.
Beginning of it.
Eh?
I think the first point of it is that it's the good reason. But
yes. Is there any example you can, perhaps recently, if you wish, in your life, where you've had a doubt about something and you realize actually it's beneficial and supportive, that the doubt is the start of a change?
Last night when I was thinking about living here, and running away home.
Yes, all right.
And not telling goodbye to anyone.
All right, so plenty of others have the...
I know I need to stay and see that the reason is, in the end, was exactly the opposite. It was the reason to stay in the end, but...
Yes. So...
it was an answer?
Yeah, sure. So... thoughts may arise. One of the most popular mantras here is, get me out of here. And there'll be a few people who haven't had these thoughts, including teachers. And despite the wave of the doubt, one has surfed the doubt. You know, surfing. You kind of surfed the doubt. And something else has been primary. So when there's no opposite, which is doubt needs some opposite, and there's no opposite, then one can be right back with the flow. And your times of doubt is to sometimes recognize and appreciate the doubt rather than fight it. So in the tradition, in the healthy aspect of doubt, because it's a stepping stone towards authentic change for some, tradition will say, small doubt, small awakening, medium-sized doubt, medium-sized awakening, big doubt, big awakening. Doubt's got its benefits. Cool, it is cool, isn't it? Yeah, I thought so too.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Cool. Nice. So we'll have a quiet moment and I'll just give a short reflection. With the explorations and inquiries which take place, there's a kind of dynamic in a certain way in which the exchange is not always easy, either for the swallower or for the person sitting beside. But there is a dynamic which is going on. And the dynamic doesn't have a straight line, it's not convenient. It wanders into the subject and it wanders out as well. Some of the questions which are asked are challenging questions, and so it requires some exploration of what is meant by the question. And to some degree, the inquiries this evening reflected that. It might be and is worthwhile in the daily life that when we are asked questions, even sometimes the light questions there, to actually, rather than just answer yes, no, both, neither, rather than just answer, actually to respond and ask a little bit about the question, maybe about the background question. What does this mean to you? What does that mean to you? And when somebody asks us a question, there's usually a lot more than just the question. A lot more about the relationship to life, the relationship to people, the relationship to oneself. And so a simple question from whoever it is could be the opportunity for a really precious conversation with another person. And quite often with children, let alone with adults, sometimes the children ask such beautiful questions to us. And if we go quiet and we say, like children ask, what will happen to me when I die? And then we say, oh, I don't know. And another child said, well, is there a God? Well, actually, I don't know. Will I come back and live again? Oh, I don't know. Children ask these deep spiritual questions of life. And if we say, I don't know, they lose confidence in us as the adults. And then they will stop asking the questions. Because there's no adult around who is willing to find out for themselves, or just willing to give a lot of time and reflection to these big and important issues of life. We owe it to ourselves, but we owe it to our children, and we owe it to our children in the classrooms, and we owe it to our friends, and we owe it to our parents. It's to keep something alive, not with the absolute assurances of things, but to ask. If we had a major debate, what is killing? What are the consequences of killing? And it really made that, not having the answers, just making that a really important dialogue in our communities. It could have massive beneficial effects, a huge amount of support. The questions which are deep and important require from us voices around who are willing to bring them up, just as you did here with me. And to find other opportunities and to use that liberated voice to ask, to question. And we're not all saying we've got all the answers and it's all... We don't. But sometimes out of the dialogue, the insights and the understanding come. And I know for myself with regard to this, with immense privileges as a servant of the Dharma, that regularly, notebook after notebook, and have a conversation, have an exchange, such as this evening. I'll go back. I remember some of the points that were said to me. I'll write them down. I'll give some more reflection. I'll meditate on them. I'll try and listen deeply. What's a way in the future that I can respond and perhaps more clearly or more insightfully or whatever? It's an ongoing process of listening to another, being mindful and respectful of their words, meditating on it, reflecting on it, writing on it, learning from it and helping to grow as a human being. But we need important and deep conversations. And a big thank you to those who came up this evening and the previous evening, because there's a quiet power to that. And we can learn from our children and receive inspiration from them. And we can learn from our partner, and we can learn from our friends and from each other. Our society deserves a much deeper conversation. Thank you for lending an ear. The time now is 8:50. And if we have, the bell ringer would kindly give the bell, thank you. In 15 minutes time, and then around 9:15, the short sitting through until 9:30 and the evening hot drink. Thank you, and thank you for the precious contributions from those who came to sit.